San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right. Good evening, everybody. I'm Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you almost live from KFMB Studios in Kearney Mesa with 50,000 watts of power on nights and weekends. So we reach not just San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up the coast to Seattle on a good night, and inland to the desert. So a lot of people out there. And now it's time for me to introduce my illustrious co-host, the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He's an estate planning expert. He has a foundation called Move Your Feet Before You Eat. He's the founder of that. He's a core member and founding member of Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable, professional speaker, co-host, and collaborator, Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you today?
I'm doing well, but it's not really evening. We'll tell the listeners why soon.
Well, it's evening when they're hearing this. But
exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right about that point.
But anyway, a couple of things. I went to the voter information night last night at High Tech High, and a lot of candidates showed up, and congratulations to them on a great event. And I just learned a very interesting factoid today that in San Diego County, the supposed conservative bastion, in the corner of the country here, has the Republican Party has now become the third party in San Diego County. There are more registered independents now, and the Democrats are in first place. So that's kind of an interesting development. And then last night, and this will help launch right into our guest, I saw something I never saw before. I was watching late night TV. I was watching Letterman. He was doing his show without a studio audience. There was nobody there except
just like us.
Cast and crew. And I got to
actually, we have a one-member audience. Yeah. Michael Coranta from UBS is sitting in here with us.
VP of UBS is here, right. Anyway, I got to say, his show, the guy is an intelligent guy, and he doesn't get a chance to show off his intellect too much with an audience. They're usually trying to be funny, but he had Jim Cantore on from the Weather Channel, and they went over a lot of information about that storm. And they also had Ken Burns on, who's going to be airing a documentary on the Dust Bowl. And I guess, most kids don't know much about the Dust Bowl, but it was a significant issue in this country. The settlers went out to the middle of the country and ripped up all the grass and planted wheat. And then I guess they had a drought and just created this big, dust storms. And one blew all the way, I know, to Washington, D.C., and they had to take emergency action, and they created the Conservation Corps, I guess, to get back there and show people how to farm correctly and let fields lie fallow and things like that. But if you don't think humans can cause a lot of damage in a short amount of time, you just need to go back to the 1930s in this country. Did you study up on that much, Richard, at all?
Well, I did. That was actually a huge catalyst for the migration west. If you read John Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath and so on, those characters emanated out of the Dust Bowl and migrated west for a better life in the 1930s.
Yeah, I remember reading the book, but I didn't quite, the impact of the Dust Bowl, the storms did not, it did not impact me as a high school student. But in any case, it will air on PBS, so just Google that, Dust Bowl, PBS, and check that out. And then Jim Cantore also was talking about the uniqueness of this storm and how, 1,000 miles. I looked it up today. The California coast is only 840 miles, so it's about 200 miles more than the entire coast of California, and that's how long this, wide this storm was. So with that, I know we have our guest on the line on the East Coast, and Richard, why don't you take it away and let everybody know who's there?
Yeah, well, short and sweet. I'm not going to say too much about him yet. We'll do that later. But our guest is Tom McLaughlin, who is head of municipal research with UBS. And I don't want to get too much into Tom's background or what he does right now. We'll do that later in the show. But I want to point out to the listeners, and I want to thank Tom. He is calling in from, well, I guess he's in Connecticut, but he typically works in New York and resides in New York. And today is actually, we recorded this on Halloween, which is Wednesday, October 31st. We didn't schedule this taping because of what's going on back east. This has been on the calendar for about a month because of Tom's travel schedule and my travel schedule. So we were planning to do this right at this time anyway for airing when you're listening now, Sunday evening, November 4th. But until this morning, we didn't even know if Tom was going to be able to get on. the show because of the power outages, the phones being out, and everything else. So, Tom, we want to thank you for your extraordinary efforts to be on, but we want to start the show by talking about not what you do for a living or what you do for UBS or municipal bonds. We want to talk about what's going on back east. So thank you and welcome.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Richard. And hello, Joe.
Hi
good
there.
To talk to you again. The weather is clearing up, which is fortunate. We got some buses running again. The New York City subway system is still out of commission, and we're not sure when that's going to come out. They actually had to pump water out of the tubes underneath the East River, and that's going to take some time.
Wow.
The subways are like the central nervous system of New York,
mm-hmm.
and when they're not running well, the whole metropolitan area feels it. So we've got the commuter rail systems down. The northern suburbs looks like they're going to get some commuter rail service on a partial basis later today.
And that's 8 million riders a day, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, when you put the commuter rail together with the subways, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the lines for the buses, not surprisingly, were dramatic this morning mm-hmm. as people tried to get back to work. I've got one colleague of mine who lives in Hoboken who was literally stranded in his apartment building with 4 feet of water all the way around his building.
Wow.
And I got another one in lower Manhattan in Stuyvesant Town. For those of your listeners who are familiar with New York, that's in an area which you wouldn't expect to flood. He actually lost his car because there was water up above the roof of the car.
Holy cow. But I know people have to be careful because you can't necessarily step into a puddle. There could be electrical current in the puddle.
Yeah, to boot, absolutely. So he's actually stuck in his apartment right now. He's got gas on the stovetop, but no heat, no electricity. So, and everybody's cell phones are running out of batteries. You know, it makes you really appreciate life's daily conveniences.
Oh, yeah, we had a blackout here a year ago.
Just over a year ago, yeah.
September
8th and 9th. And, when the whole town goes black, boy, you feel like you're back in the caveman days, right?
Absolutely. But, Tom, exactly where do you live? Exactly where do you typically work? And exactly where are you sitting right now?
Well, I live in Westport, Connecticut.
Okay.
And the branch manager here at UBS in Westport was kind enough to give me an office. I usually work in New York City at 1285 6th Avenue, which is Midtown,
mm-hmm.
But there was just no way I was going to get in. I mean, I probably could have tried to drive in, but frankly, they were suggesting people try to avoid doing that because the congestion was going to be so bad on the few bridges that were still open.
Yeah. How many years you been in New York, Tom?
Well, I was born and raised in New York. I lived in California for about 9 years, down in Virginia for about 5 years. I find myself back in New York now for the last 7 years.
So have you ever seen anything close to this weather-wise?
That was my question.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, we expected Irene last year, and obviously your listeners who were watching the TV have probably heard about Irene.
Mm-hmm.
That was last year's storm. We were expecting it to be pretty bad, and it turned out, fortunately, not to be. This one turned out to be just as bad as people anticipated.
Where were you when the storm hit, Tom? Were you home or at the office? Or
I was home. We were actually, taking heed of the warnings that were coming out of Governor Malloy, Governor Cuomo, Governor Christie, and just staying home and hunkering down.
Yeah.
It was pretty bad. It was I lost a tree in my backyard and missed the house by about 10 yards.
Oh, my God.
About a 75-foot tree.
Oh, my God. Jeez. It's unbelievable.
So, do you have kids?
I do. I've got two. One's over in Europe studying, and the other one is a senior in high school.
So she's home.
College
okay.
applications out of the way.
So no school this week, I'm assuming, or
no school so far, which is kind of a mixed blessing. You know, the first day or two, it's like, okay, everybody's safe and sound, so we're thankful for that. And he's got no school. I think he's starting to go a little bit stir crazy at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is the market open today, though?
The market opened back up today.
Yeah.
It's interesting though. A lot of offices in New York have got intermittent cell. Internet
service,
and
service.
Phone service.
Yeah.
So you can make a lot of phone calls out, you can't get it in, or vice versa.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's a bit choppy right now.
Huh. Oh, my God. That's our first segment already? My gosh. Hang on, Tom. Hang on, Richard. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after this short break. All right, we're back with It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Musio and senior wealth management expert and bond specialist Tom McLaughlin in calling from the Westport, Connecticut office of UBS. So welcome back, gentlemen.
Thanks. So Tom, we were talking a little bit about some of the personal effects and some of the things you witnessed and experienced given the storm, but let's talk about the economic effects. I know, again, you are head of municipal research, so this is a little bit out of your expertise, but certainly I know you guys are tracking the economics behind this disaster very closely because, it was huge.
Yeah, we are. I spoke with one of my colleagues who's a macroeconomist, and asked him what he thought the aggregate damages were going to be. And he cited a report coming out of Equicat, which is an insurance consulting firm, that the property and casualty damages will be in the range of $5 to $10 billion. The economic loss, if you include the property and casualty plus the economic productivity losses, is probably $10 to $20 billion. But importantly, that number excludes the cost of rebuilding
mm-hmm.
the public infrastructure. So if you and so I kind of pressed him some more, and his view is, if you assume, if you take Irene as a base case last year, which didn't turn out to be as bad, using Equicat's numbers, you could see total damages, and this includes infrastructure rebuilding, of $65 to $75 billion.
Wow.
Holy cow.
It's a big number.
It's like a Marshall Plan for New York and the East Coast there, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, as you said at the top of the show, this is a very wide-ranging storm, and, you know, it's going from Cape Cod down to D.C.
Yeah, people don't realize the blizzard's hitting West Virginia. I mean, 26 inches of snow over there. I mean, and they don't typically get snow like that, do they?
No, well, not this early in the season. And, and you're right, probably not that much at any given moment. This was just a clash of competing storm fronts. You know, in terms of municipals, this kind of a storm does have a pronounced effect on cities. The biggest impact, not surprisingly, is going to be on cities that are already struggling with limited financial flexibility, those that are already stretched here in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
And you may well see a productivity decline. The real question is whether or not it's going to be offset by what we call the Home Depot effect. Usually you'll see an increase in economic activity a month or two after this kind of an event as rebuilding kicks in. Contractors are put back to work, supplies at hardware stores and the like fly off the shelves. And as long as the tax, the sales tax, is not suspended, and we saw that after the hurricane in New Orleans a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But as long as this tax revenue, taxes are not suspended, the revenues actually do pick up.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this real big short-term productivity loss, and we're certainly seeing it this week in New York with everybody at home or working kind of ad hoc. But then a month or two in, you could see a bit of a surge, and whether it balances out is an open question, but you would see an increase in tax revenue.
Well, let me ask you about the insurance industry. Now, obviously, there's going to be a lot of claims. Is there any danger of them running out of funds? I mean, this is such a devastating, huge storm. I mean, who's in good shape? Who's in bad shape? Anything to worry about on that front?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to answer that one just because I don't cover the individual property and casualty insurers.
Mm-hmm.
But we do expect to have a report out at the end of the week, which we'll make sure is available to you so you can share it with your listeners
mm-hmm.
as to which firms are doing relatively better post-storm.
Yeah, we would love to see that.
Yeah.
So Tom, today is actually, we're taping this on Wednesday, October 31, Halloween. You say there's people back in your office now at UBS?
There are some. Most of the individuals, right now power is out south of 39th Street.
Okay.
Colleagues who are living in the Upper West Side or the Upper East Side have been able to get to work, either if they're fortunate enough to catch a cab or they'll hike down to 51st Street mm-hmm. where we are. If you're down below 39th, you're probably not getting to the office. If you're out in the suburbs, if you were up by 4:30 this morning and could do the commute, you could probably get in. But it's tough right now. I mean, I think we're not going to be back to full strength, and I think that's true for most financial services firms until Monday.
Well, and is it a slow trading day today, or what's going on there?
Yeah, no, it's relatively slow just because there's so much difficulty in terms of choppiness, in terms of the electronics. It's amazing when you look back on it how dependent we've become mm-hmm. in society based on the electronic
media. Yeah, well, no, I mean, it's absolutely, I mean, for example, cell phones. You go, well, great, I have a cell phone. Well, guess what? When it runs out of power, how do you recharge it?
Well, the line out the municipal library and a few of the stores that are offering recharging stations is just something to see at this point.
Yeah, when we got our power outage, I was lucky enough to find a battery-operated transistor radio I had stashed somewhere, thank God, but because you don't want to use your cell phone or iPad in case you're out. You know. Now, as far as your home, your power is out there, and when did it go out, and when do you expect it down again?
We lost it at 2:45 in the afternoon on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
It's now Wednesday afternoon, so it's been out 2 days.
Wow.
You know, they're saying it could be three or four more. Fortunately, my brother's got a generator, so we got the entire family lining up for hot showers over at his house.
And food. I mean, how do you cook and all that? I mean,
Yeah, well, you know, this actually goes into the numbers when you talk about productivity losses. There's other types of economic loss, and food spoilage is something because it's a lot of people are going to be hurling a lot of stuff out into the garbage. That it's kind of a shame.
But speaking of communications, now this is not funny, but it's funny in this context. We traded emails yesterday, and you were like at a Staples store because it was a Wi-Fi spot, right?
Oh yeah, it was pretty funny. I actually I couldn't get into the library because it was too crowded. I ended up finding a Wi-Fi hotspot in front of the Staples office supply store, and it was actually a pretty darn good one because the signal was extremely strong.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the parking lot with my laptop trying to pick up all my messages.
Yeah, because the story behind the story, we actually had lunch with one of your cohorts, head of your investment committee, Michael Ryan, here on Monday in San Diego. And so I said to Mike Coranta after lunch, I said, we need to track Tom down because I'm sure he's back in New York right now. And we're supposed to tape, 10:30 my time, 1:30 his time on Wednesday, and he may not even be able to have any reception.
Yeah, Mike and I actually traded calls really quickly on his cell phone just to check on each other's families, make sure we're okay.
Yeah, and make sure you give him huge grief when he gets back, because he got to spend the whole storm in San Diego while he left his wife behind.
The last two times, actually, we've had big storms where we lost power here in Connecticut, I was on the road as well, and I can guarantee you do catch grief when you go home.
Yeah. So
just think if the Yankees were in the World Series, I mean, and this was hitting, I mean, you might have to play it before an
episode. Well, that's dreaming, Joe. That was really dreaming right
well,
there.
But, I'm just saying,
So, Tom, before we get onto the subject matter of the show, which I guess we'll do after the next break, New York City Marathon scheduled for this Sunday, is it planned to go on?
It looks like at this point that it's planned to go on. There was an open question this morning as to whether or not the Knicks and the Nets are going to start playing basketball at the new Barclays Center in Brooklyn. I think they may have come to a conclusion, but I haven't been able to pick up the news yet as to whether they're going to play that game a couple of days earlier.
But here's the challenge with the marathon. Is the ferry running? Because I know about 50% of the runners get to the start line by using the ferry.
Yeah, they do. They leave out of Battery Park, which, of course, is one of the places that got hit hard.
Right.
So I'm not sure how they're going to pull that off. But, everybody here is working. And I have to say, from a social aspect, everybody's really kind of pulling in everybody, helping each other out. So it's possible that we actually get the Perry system back up and running by Saturday.
Yeah, because I think running the marathon would be a huge boost in terms of just the psychology of
sure.
the situation,
yeah,
just to get out and to promote the resiliency of the city and the citizens and how everybody comes together in these times. I mean, I think it would just be great, even though, I mean, there won't be as many runners as normal because a lot of people simply can't get in, and a lot of the elite runners want to get in by Tuesday or Wednesday to prepare, and they obviously can't do that.
Well, I hear that there's a lot of work crews coming from out of state into New York and the East Coast to help get the wires back up and everything else.
Yeah, we've been bringing them in as far as Texas, we're going to need it.
I think we're sending some from San Diego,
we are.
I heard.
Yeah.
No kidding, wow.
Some of the reserve.
Well, I'm happy to have them here.
Yeah, we got to take another break, though, Tom, so hang on, and we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after these announcements. Welcome back to It's Your Money and Your Life, the special Halloween edition that we pre-taped on Halloween morning, and you're hearing it Sunday night. And now over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
We want to thank all of our wonderful sponsors, not the least of which, of course, is UBS. Again, we have Mr. Michael Coranta, one of the vice presidents of UBS in studio. We have one more audience member than David Letterman. Yes, we beat Letterman by one. One person. So whatever it takes. But also we want to thank Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited, Joel Grushkin and his partner Kurt Gotro with Cost Segregation Initiatives, my favorite CFO on the planet, Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, Rich Gaines, who's going to be our guest on November 11th with Family Legacy Legal, our favorite CPAs on the planet, Polito Epic Associates, that's Paul Polito, CPA, and Don Epic, CPA, and of course, Regents Bank and the best business banker in San Diego, Mr. Sean Puckett. But back to the show. Again, thank you to all the sponsors.
Yes, thanks very much. And if you need to find out any more information about them or contact information, just go to our website, iymoney.com. There's a sponsor tab there, and all the information is there, emails, phone numbers, everything you need. So anyway, back to you, Tom. You still there?
I'm still here.
Excellent. Everyone's kind of wondering, with the election coming up next Tuesday, how much is this storm going to impact the election turnout results, et cetera? Has anyone speculated on that?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation and not a whole lot of consensus. However, I think given the fact that the storm happened when it did, coming in on Monday evening in a rage, but now departing, there's probably 4 days of solid cleanup work, and by Monday we should have most of the power back on. So, you know, by the time the election takes place the following day on Tuesday, we'll be in a position, I think, where it won't harm turnout. There'll be some pockets of areas down in Brooklyn, of a Breezy Point and Hoboken, where it got hit so hard. Those precincts will have very low turnout. But in terms of the metropolitan area, I think we'll be okay.
And of course, there's Virginia, West Virginia, the whole coast. I mean, we're wondering what might happen. It's hard to say. But anyway, I just like to plug, you know, voting by mail. I've always gotten my ballot in the mail. I know the whole state of Oregon requires everyone to vote by mail. I guess it does save money from, you know, staffing polling stations and machines. But
Joe, I hadn't thought about that, but you could see, you're absolutely right, you could see a kind of a groundswell of support for mail-in after this event, because had the storm occurred a couple of days later, it would have been a totally different story. Mm-hmm.
And for more early voting. But anyway, Richard, you weren't again...
Yeah, Tom, so question. So we're going to sort of segue into the subject matter of our show. You, again, are the head of municipal research for UBS. Out here in California, we, of course, are having an election on Tuesday as well, but we've got this thing called Proposition 30, which would increase state income and sales taxes. And so I just wanted to ask the question, California bonds and the effect of whether Prop 30 passes or doesn't pass, how would you project this, both over the short term, the immediate reaction, as well over the long term, depending on how this thing goes?
Well, it's interesting. Prop 30, we will have two different reactions, short-term and long-term. Prop 30 initially had very strong poll results that have weakened over time. Mm-hmm. It's really now a toss-up, as you know. To the extent that Prop 30 fails, you might see an initial widening of spreads, just because people are going to be more concerned about the actions that the state government is going to have to take without the revenue coming in for Prop 30.
So when you say a widening of spreads, what does that mean to an investor?
You may see some people sell out of the name. Not a lot. I want to emphasize that this is not likely to be a mass sell-off, and for this very important reason. California is a relatively, in fact, it is a high-tech state. I'm not going to use the term relatively. And as a consequence, California taxes on bonds do provide a very important tax shelter. So it's not likely that you're going to see people sell out en masse. You might see some institutional investors sell on a negative result in Prop 30. In other words, a negative result from the investor standpoint where it doesn't pass. But that would be short-lived, I think, and primarily because the overarching importance of California geo bonds, for example, as being a tax shelter. So you'll see a lot of attention being directed towards the results on Prop 30. I think it's weakened, by the way, for a whole variety of reasons. You know, you had the Parks Department embarrassments vis-a-vis their budget.
Mm-hmm.
You had the gas price spike in the state.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting mixed messages with criticism coming from supporters of Prop 38, which is a competing measure to raise taxes. You've got some recognition that some of the revenue to the state is going to be directed towards pension contributions, as well as, you know, money for the classrooms. And you've also got some negative coverage on high-speed rail. So you've got all these factors that are coalescing that are basically proving to be an uphill battle. To the extent that Prop 30 passes, again, the immediate reaction is going to be, okay, I'm an investor in California bonds. We now have more revenue coming in. This is a question that is divorced from the public policy question as to whether or not it's a good thing or not. This is just an immediate reaction on the part of investors. But in the long term, to the extent, even if Prop 30 fails, I think in the long term, you're not going to basically see a mass sell-off, and you could probably see those spreads come back in, because even without Prop 30 raising the income tax, California is likely to stay a high-tax state.
Well, so related question, and this is sort of a three-pronged question. So getting past Prop 30 and just looking at California more, shall we say, as a whole, we have three issues here in California that, and I want to get your take on what it means for just issues here in California in general. Obviously, as you mentioned, there's divisiveness on the California High-Speed Rail Initiative. We also are in the process of efforts or attempts at public pension reform here at the state level, as well as at many local or municipal levels in California. And then lastly, we have certain municipalities or cities in California, Stockton being at the top of the list, that, you know, are large cities that are having, well, fiscal issues. So three things sort of working together.
Yeah. Which one do you want to tackle first?
Whatever order you want to go in.
Well, let's do California high-speed rail because it's probably the most straightforward. As you recall, Prop 1A was passed by voters in 2008, providing for $9 billion of GO bonds, general obligation bonds. That question promised voters a 2-hour and 40-minute trip between San Francisco and Los Angeles, competitive fares, or I should say fares competitive with airlines, and a total cost of $33 billion. Now, 4 years later, we're in a position where the high-speed rail is going to have to share the right-of-way with Caltrain between San Francisco and San Jose. That right-of-way has got a lot of at-grade crossings, and there's no way you're going to run it at high speed down the peninsula.
Yeah, it's like 240 just to get to San Francisco to San Jose, but anyway.
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, it's just going to slow it down, so I think the 240 seems to me to be just, I don't see how you can pull that off. The cost has now gone from $33 billion to $68 billion. And you're highly unlikely that the round trip, I think, between L.A. and San Francisco, or at least the L.A.-San Diego metro region and the San Francisco Bay Area, is not going to look more attractive by air, because you've got, as you know, you've got three airports in the San Francisco Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose. You've got six down in Southern California, and you've got a lot more flexibility, and those fares are pretty darn competitive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a project that is going to take until 2029 at the earliest to complete. That's assuming everything goes according to Hoyle. To get the high-speed rail down to Anaheim, it's probably past 2030. And I just don't see, frankly, how they're going to be able to pull that off. So they seem intent on proceeding with the project. They've turned earth in the Central Valley. They want to build that Central Valley line, by the way, because that's the main corridors from which you're going to get from San Francisco to Los Angeles. They want to build that because they know they have to build the spine of the system, otherwise it'll never get built.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, that spine is not going to serve very many passengers, to say the least. So it's a project that is going to be far more expensive and is going to be subject to, I think, a lot more competitive pressure than voters perhaps realized in 2008 when they supported the bond project.
Mm-hmm.
A lot's changed since 2008, of course.
Well, hold that thought there, though, Tom. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after these announcements. All right, we're back with another segment of It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Muscio and Tom McLaughlin in Westport, Connecticut, the UBS office there. Welcome back, everybody.
Yeah, and so speaking about the rail system, my sister-in-law, Kelly, once did the drive from San Francisco to Los Angeles in under 3 hours, so maybe we should just have her be the solution.
But I'm not sure that'd be highly recommended.
I don't think it's... She didn't get pulled over, but she should have. Real quickly, getting back to impacts on investors in municipal bonds here in California, let's talk ever so briefly about efforts at pension reform in California, as well as, well, what do things like blow-ups in Stockton mean?
Yeah, you know, it's a very big subject. I'll try to kind of give a synopsis in a couple of minutes, but, you know, we're in a position right now where we've got, in the United States, an aging population, and you've got insufficient employer contributions. That is, cities, counties, the state are not putting enough money to accommodate the pension benefits that have been promised to workers. There's another issue, though, and that's we actually have a lot of unrealistic investment assumptions. If you go back and take a look at what the investment return average assumption is, it's about 7.8%. If you take the largest pension plans in around the country, 126 largest plans, it's about 7.8%. That's what they're assuming they're going to earn each year over time. And yet, if you look at historically, over the last 10 years, those same pension plans have only earned about 5.7. And over the last 5 years, 2%. So what we've got is a lot of assumptions that are not likely to play out. And so the question is, you know, what kind of reforms are you going to introduce? And the state of California did introduce a pension reform package, which was, you know, listen, on the whole, it's good that there was some reform package passed. You can't say this is a bad development. It's a good one. But it's probably not enough. The changes that are most common are you're adjusting some benefit formulas, you're raising the retirement age, and you're increasing contributions from current employees.
Mm-hmm.
And California has done all of those things. What it hasn't done yet is introduce a hybrid program where you move new employees into kind of a modified 401k where you've got a defined benefit component and you've got a defined contribution component. Governor Brown, to his credit, did promote that, but couldn't get legislative support for it. So that part of the pension reform package did die in committee. So on the whole, this is something that's not going to go away. We're going to be wrestling with this problem for at least a decade. And at the end of the day, I think there is only one solution, which is that over time, more of the public employees will have to be gradually shifted over to a defined contribution component, similar to what we see in the private sector.
I think our city of San Diego just passed a proposition compelling employees to get into the...
You know, it's interesting. The San Diego proposition and the San Jose proposition were very important to adding impetus to legislative action in Sacramento, because, you know, San Diego is generally viewed, at least in Sacramento, as a Republican town, and San Jose is viewed as a Democratic town. You had both sides of the political spectrum basically pushing for pension reform. It perhaps gave some cover to legislators in Sacramento. And I'm just cynical enough to believe that the desire to pass Prop 30 had something to do with the fact that the reform measure did pass.
I think you're right. Any quick comments on Stockton or other municipalities that are having issues?
Well, Stockton's kind of the poster child for profligate spending. The economic recession undermined its ability to operate the infrastructure built on borrowing. They're defending themselves against the suit, more properly, from investors after the city of Stockton decided to default on seven issues. Here's an important distinction for your listeners, though. What Stockton decided to do was not appropriate funds for its lease revenue bonds and its pension obligation bonds. Its utility revenue bonds seem unaffected at this point. They expect to be paid. We believe that there's an important distinction to be made between general obligation bonds on the one hand and lease revenue bonds and pension obligation bonds on the other. The latter, the lease revenue bonds and pension obligation bonds, are less secure. This is something that's going to play out in litigation, in bankruptcy court, and then in all likelihood it's going to be appealed to the Federal Circuit Court. And we'll find out over the course of 2 or 3 years whether or not CalPERS, the contributions that Stockton or any other city makes to CalPERS, has any sort of a priority claim ahead of investors. This is the very important issue that Stockton's bankruptcy is going to decide for the municipal market. And obviously, from an investment perspective, you'd want CalPERS to be in the same position as any other investor. They claim, that is, the pension fund claims that they are, in fact, superior. But again, this is something that'll get played out in court over a couple, 3 years.
Fascinating case. Going to be fascinating to watch. And we only have a couple minutes to go. Let's expand the focus a little bit, a little bit more national. Tax reform and sequestration, effect on the municipal market. Any thoughts?
We think the prospects for tax reform are higher now than they ever have been, at least since 1986 when the Tax Reform Act was passed. The Obama administration has proposed in its last two budgets to limit the exemption from tax-exempt income to those in the 28% tax bracket or below. But I think it's not just the Obama administration. If you take a look at the political spectrum, the left wing of the Democratic Party has always been skeptical of tax exemption because the benefits skew to the more affluent in higher tax brackets, which is mathematically correct. But interestingly enough, the right wing of the Republican Party is not so enamored with them either for a couple of reasons. One is that there's a view, at least among some members of the conservative caucus, that it promotes profligate spending and borrowing, which cities and counties can no longer afford. And it basically represents a subsidy from more conservative states to more aggressively borrowing states, if you will. So now you've got both ends of the spectrum being skeptical of tax exemption. And you're also in a position where the big five components of the federal budget are Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, defense, and interest on the national debt. You can't solve this deficit problem we have without at least looking and scrutinizing Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and defense. And we're doing that through sequestration. We're cutting quite a bit into defense, for example. To limit further cuts, I think you're going to get a political consensus coming out of Washington that something called tax expenditures have to be addressed. Tax expenditures in Washington parlance are tax shelters. And the tax exempt, municipal tax exemption, as it's calculated by the Congressional Budget Office, costs the federal government about $44 billion a year. If you take all the tax shelters that are existing in the Internal Revenue Code, it equates to about $1 trillion on a $3.8 trillion budget. So it's real money. It's a real part. It's a real component. The only way you go after any of these tax expenditures, I would argue, is to do them all at once. Because if you go after the mortgage interest deduction, for example, the National Association of Realtors is going to be able to shoot that down through aggressive lobbying.
Mm-hmm.
Any recipient of a tax expenditure is going to take the same tack. But what happens if, in the course of trying to reduce the deficit, and there's a consensus in Washington that we have to do that, all of the tax expenditures, all of them, are addressed and curtailed at least to some modest degree? Then you've got a situation where tax reform actually has a shot. And I would argue that it would pass regardless of whether or not President Obama is reelected or Governor Romney is elected. You could even make the case that if Governor Romney is elected, you might actually have a higher likelihood of it happening. Importantly for your listeners, we don't believe, however, that the federal government would go back and retroactively tax municipal bonds already issued. And that's a really important concept. We don't think that, we do think that there would be grandfathered. We don't think there's a whole lot of appetite among members of Congress to go back to their constituents and say that municipal bond you bought 4 or 5 years ago is now going to be subject to some taxation. Is it possible? Yeah, it's possible. But is it likely? We don't think so.
Interesting. You know, I would think these tax reform measures, and maybe get your opinion on this, if they would tie, any kind of increase in revenue or increase in tax with spending cuts, like for every dollar we raise, we're going to cut revenue spending by $1 or $1.50, whatever. I think voters would be more likely to support something like that, don't you?
Well, I think so. It's hard to do though because you've got so much of the federal budget is driven by those big four components: mm-hmm. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and defense. And therefore, if you add those four plus the interest on the national debt, which you can't touch, you've got a vast majority of the federal dollars already spoken for, and so you can't cut that deeply everywhere else without really cutting into other essential services. The budget sequestration Act was, it's a term, I should say, adopted by Congress for those automatic spending cuts that are applied across the board, and that was what was viewed as politically palatable early last year. It's a result of a failure by Congress or the Congressional Super Committee to have any sort of compromise on deficit reduction. So I wouldn't disagree, Joe. I think it's a very, very difficult thing, and that's one reason why I think those tax shelters, the tax expenditures, are such a target right now for both the members of Congress and the permanent staff in the Joint Tax Committee.
Tom, really appreciate it. We can't thank you enough.
Yeah, thank you.
Safest regards. We've got to tune out now, and also make sure you give Mike Ryan some heat when he gets home.
Yeah, gotcha. Anyway, Tom, thank you very much. Thank you, Michael Caranta, for being in studio with us. Thank you. Richard, have a great week. Get out and vote, everybody. We'll see you next week on It's Your Money and Your Life. Thanks for listening.
I'm Nick Soboleski, a SelectQuote agent with a true story of how SelectQuote goes to bat for you buying term life insurance. A while back, a man called me who had prostate cancer. He asked if I could beat a very high quote another life insurance agent had given him. I said, let me see. Well, I took his pertinent information, then shopped the highly rated, price-competitive companies we represent, and found one who pre-approved him for a premium way below what he had been quoted. When it comes to term life insurance, no other company touches SelectQuote's experience and expertise in finding the right policy at the right price for almost anyone. How about you?
For your free quote, call 1-800-500-1690. That's 1-800-500-1690. 1-800-500-1690. Or go to SelectQuote.com. We shop, you save.
We follow the story. Then we conversation.
I think it'd be helpful to have a president who actually understands job creation.
Follow the leader. 760 KFMB.